So we're talking to Ian Bigger here about his radio memories. And Ian, after working in the Pirates in County Louth, you then moved to Cork. So tell us a little bit about that move and how it came about.
So so I was back home in Scotland after being in Drogheda. I got a call from Eric Vaughan, who in turn had a call from Colm McParlin, who was a Boyneside engineer, saying that there was a station opening in Cork and would I be interested in joining. And I said, well, yeah, I am. Obviously, I thought about going to The Voice of Peace with Don Allen, but that never came around. So I thought, well, yeah, we'll go to Cork. Eric said there was money being paid, which was good, obviously. And did I know anybody else who was interested in joining? So I mentioned a friend of mine called Paul Graham, who had just come back from Ireland from a station called WABC. In Ballyhadreen. I phoned him and he was interested in going across. So we decided we'd head over to Cork, or Cork City, as I thought it was. So we got over there. I arrived. Eric picked me up at Cork train station after getting the train down from Dublin, and we headed off to the country. It was actually to Ballycotton in County Cork, which is a lovely seaside village. 20 odd miles from Cork City itself, and that's where the station had been set up.
And this was ERI.
This was ERI, or East Side Radio, as it was at the time. It had been set up as a summer project for the family's children, just to keep them busy during the summer months. It was the O'Connor family who owned some engineering businesses in Cork. And they had a summer house in Ballycott, and this is where the radio station had been set up. Colm McParlin had heard the broadcast and gone over to visit them, and had said to them, well, you know, we can make this into a commercial venture if you're interested. I think the FM transmitter originally had come from Cork City Local Radio and hadn't worked that well. So Colm, I think, supplied them with a new FM and also one of his medium wave transmitters, which was a couple of hundred watts. So it given quite good coverage across East Cork. So we arrived, myself and Eric and Paul Graham, we started doing programmes from Ballycotton. Now, the good thing about the O'Connor family was that they were quite progressive in their approach to things. They could see how you need to invest in something to then recoup from that. So they were very much interested in expanding the radio station, and they were quite open to any suggestions that we might come up with. So one of the first things thought is, why not get a better transmitter, increase the coverage, and be able to, you know, set yourself in a more stable commercial footing. So they were up for that. One of the guys that I contact in America, a company called Besco, who sold transmitters to the likes of Radio Caroline, from there they purchased a 5 kilowatt Continental Electronics medium wave transmitter, which was duly shipped over from the States without too much problems, if I remember rightly, because Mrs. O'Connor had some contacts in the department, so it was imported quite easily into the country, and then set up at White's Cross, just outside Cork City, near Glanmire. The transmitter was installed there and fired up on air around about September 1982.
And that was a big investment, and wouldn't have been cheap, and 5 kilowatts was a significant power to be putting out on AM.
It was, you know, and it took the station beyond just Cork, because with that kind of power, you're going to cover sort of parts of Waterford. In fact, I can remember, and I still sort of reminisce with Andy Linton, who was working at Southside Radio, Sewerside Radio at the time. We put the big transmitter on 1332 kilohertz. ERI normally used 1305. We put the big transmitter on 1332, which was Sewerside's frequency. And within about half an hour, Andy was on the phone to us saying, hey, you'll have to move, you know, you're blotting us out in Waterford, you know. So that transmitter was covering Waterford, it was getting into Limerick, Tipperary, really covering, you know, as the station was intended to, covering most of Munster, you know. with that kind of power. So they invested in a transmitter, they invested in new studio equipment, cart machines and the like, some new jingles from the States as well. So really from being a summer project for the kids, it turned into to a commercial radio station all within 2 or 3 months.
And did the studio move from Ballycotton at this time as well?
It did, yeah. It was hastened by the fact that somebody was jamming us. We were linking, which was daft when you think about it, we were linking on FM from Ballycotton to Cork City, which is quite a distance really, you know, 20-odd miles linking. So somebody, and we don't know who to this day, decided to jam the link, which kind of hastened our move from Ballycotton to Cork City. So yeah, we set up some studios in Porter Cabins, very much like Sunshine Radio, next to the O'Connor's house in White's Cross. And that's where ERI was really set up and really got into the business in anger, you know.
And it was a pretty significant station, you know, similar to perhaps to some of the Dublin Super Pirates at the time.
It was, yeah. Both in the real key ingredient that ERI had was the O'Connors knew how to market it, and they were willing to invest in marketing the station. And they did all sorts of stuff, like you know, they did loads of road shows. You had people out on Patrick's Bridge in Cork, you know, handing out leaflets. They actually had a PR team who wore an ERI uniform, you know, and went around the city promoting the station. They knew exactly what they were doing, you know, and and I've said this to Joe O'Connor, and you know, latterly, it was a pleasure to work for them because they really had the best interests of the station in mind, you know.
Would it be right to think that paralleling Dublin and Cork, that ERI was Nova and South Coast was Sunshine?
Pretty much so, yeah. I mean, yeah, I think that's probably a good comparison. South Coast had started maybe about 3 months earlier than ERI, with some Cork guys who had broken away from mainly Radio City, I think, along with some guys from Dublin. A couple of English guys as well. Keith York was one of the main, he was engineer there. So that there was a big rivalry. And that goes back to your earlier point about socialising with the station staff. As I mentioned, in Drogheda, we didn't really do that. In Cork, we did. We had a few good nights there, which was very much frowned upon by the O'Connor family, you know, for whatever reason. They didn't like us socialising with the South Coast guys, which we did probably most weekends, you know. But, and then probably the worst thing that happened was, I think I was doing the breakfast show one morning about 7:30, and Keith York and Terry Vicari, who was the South Coast engineer, arrived up at ERI, you know. They were in the studio with me. And of course, Joe O'Connor then walks into the studio with a couple of South Coast guys in there, you know. So that didn't go down too well. But we were mates, you know, and we didn't see why that kind of ruling should affect our friendship, you know.
Apart from the desire of the owners to make some money out of these projects, and like all ventures and in kind of business, there's risks attached and you might not make those millions that you wanted to make. Was there something else that was driving all of these stations to be coming on in this very short period of time? Was there a copycat mentality between cities and what was going on, the loopholes being exploited? Was there something greater than just individual business people wanting to have operations?
I think Cork City and Cork people would see themselves as being very individual and very different from Dublin. So I don't think they would model themselves in Dublin at all, you know. I think in the case of South Coast, and in the case of ERI, they were purely financial money-making ventures, you know. They were out to make money, using radio as a platform for that. And they did, you know, and especially in the case of ERI, because they did it right. You know, they invested money to make money, and by golly, they made money, you know. They made a lot of money. I'd say ERI financially was probably the most successful station in Ireland, you know, more successful than Nova. It was on the air longer than Nova, you know, so, you know, but by simple mathematics, you would say they make more money. Okay, I mean, Dublin's a bigger city, but, you know, agency ads are agency ads, you know, in Cork or Dublin, you know, so they're going to make a lot of money.
Would it be fair to say that your Cork journey and ventures down there were your most fruitful?
From a professional point of view, definitely, yeah. Because, you know, it was like working, not to, you know, decry Boyneside Radio in any way, because Boyneside Radio was a good regional radio station. But in Cork City, we were working, you know, using, you know, professional equipment. We had a professional radio station as a rival with professional presenters. So you've got to be on top of your game in that situation, you know. So, yeah, from that point of view, I think, you know, the Cork experience was for me the best one, yeah. For that.
So the raids in Dublin in 1983, Radio Nova was raided, Sunshine was raided in Dublin. This had a chill effect on many other stations who closed down voluntarily. There was jamming around the same time and so on. How did that play out in Cork around the same period for ERI and South Coast Radio?
Yeah. Well, I think there was some trepidation. South Coast did close down temporarily, but returned to the air, you know, when it seemed that the teams weren't sort of moving down to Cork City. There were rumours that after they'd dealt with Nova and Sunshine, they were going to move down to Cork and deal with the stations there. South Coast closed down temporarily, very short period of time. ERI, the story was quite different because, now I'd left ERI by this time, but a very good friend of mine to this day, Paul Graham, was station manager there at the time, and he'd received a tip-off from somebody that the teams were going to come down to Cork. So he took it upon himself to remove the equipment from the studio. Wires were just cut and everything sort of taken away and hidden. Now, unfortunately, this had an adverse effect on his relationship with the people at ERI who thought it was the wrong thing to do. Robin, the engineer, who was a good friend of ours as well, he took exception to the fact of you know, the act had been carried out in dismantling the studio. And really, you know, Paul Graham feels to this day that that was the catalyst for him to leave ERI, which he did just a week or so later, you know. So, it did have a big effect on the station. I think ERI was off the air for several days until they sort of put everything back together again, you know. But there was a lot of fear at the time, but ultimately I think they just brushed it off and got on with things once it had all died down, you know.
And there was never any raid on ERI itself, as far as I know.
No, there's never any raid on ERI or South Coast. ERI was closed by an injunction, I think, about 1986. I can't remember what the circumstances were, but they were off the air for a period of time. But no actual raid by the department, no.
Across all the stations you worked on, would you have kind of any experience that would give you an insight into working for stations that are run by radio people as opposed to radio stations that are not run by radio people?
I think just to take that, you know, to another degree, I mean, that there's different types of radio people who have different views on how radio stations should be run, you know. So, I mean, we all have differing views, and that that caused a lot of friction in, you know, certainly, you know, probably... certainly one, maybe a couple of the radio stations I work for, you know, we think things should be done in different ways. So, I mean, that causes a lot of rivalry, a lot of friction, a lot of bad feeling in radio stations, which sometimes is difficult to repair. Non-radio people, I suppose that they're just into it to make money. But I think that the subtle difference is the non-radio people, if they put their trust in radio people to run the radio station, then that's a good thing. It's when the non-radio people are constantly interfering and making decisions based on what they think, based on no knowledge, based on no experience, then that's when it starts to become dangerous. Now, I didn't experience that in Ireland. I did experience that in local radio in Scotland, you know, where people who don't have a clue about radio, don't have a clue about music, make decisions that really have a severe impact on the radio station.
To me, and this is a personal comment, it sounds like you described Century Radio.
Yeah, possibly, yeah. Possibly.
I suppose, how do you exit Cork? And then we'll move on to some kind of more philosophical questions about pirate radio.
Okay, so my final exit from Cork, how can I put it? I was very young in those days, and I had quite strong views on how radio should be done, and I think my views probably got me into trouble more than once, you know. So I was let go from ERI for no particular reason. I think just because I'd upset people. And, you know, the person that let me go is one of those people we just explained there. Someone who knew absolutely nothing about radio, knew absolutely nothing about music, therefore knew nothing about music radio, so had no clue whatsoever, you know. How he ever got involved in radio, I'll never know. He's mentioned frequently in that Cork Radio Pirate book. I won't say who the person is. Anybody who knows me well knows who that person is. But it's just a good example of someone who has no idea about radio making a decision that affects a radio station and affects a career of somebody who was dedicated to that radio station, you know.
And when did you move on then from ERI?
So that would be around February 83.
Okay.
February 83.
Okay. And where did you go then?
So I went back to Scotland then and applied to local radio stations in Scotland with absolutely no luck whatsoever. As I mentioned to you earlier, I had one opportunity that I passed up that probably I shouldn't, you know. But, you look at all these things in hindsight. So there's nothing really happening in radio in Scotland for me at that time. I contemplated going back to Ireland a few times, but didn't. So got into other things for a period. And then about 1987, I got the radio bug once again and started doing stuff for Z103.
In Omeath
in County Louth, broadcasting into the north, probably coverage area as far as Mid-Ulster, Portadown, Craigavon, Lurgan, round about that area, Newry and so on, you know.
So one of the many so-called border blaster pirates of the late 80s deliberately beaming their signal into the northern market.
Yeah, and you know, very, very popular as well, you know. I mean, I can remember being at Z103 and, you know, loads of requests and dedications coming through on the phone line, you know. It was a very popular station and a good station as well, you know, a lot of good people involved in that. I mean, my stay with them was fairly short. It was from probably about May 87 until September, October. Part of that time doing pre-recorded programmes for them in my studio in Scotland, which, as I mentioned earlier, they always paid for those programmes, which was great. It was just, from my case, a matter of keeping my hand in until I eventually managed to make inroads to radio in Scotland, you know.
And, of course, during all of this time, you were building up your own archive. So going right back to, I suppose, the 70s, you were recording on cassette. You were pulling in these distant Irish stations, low power initially and then higher power. So you have a huge amount of material, a very important resource. So tell us about how this began and how you built this up over the years and what kind of equipment you were using and so on.
Well, I suppose a so-called anorak has a certain kind of psyche, you know. I mean, they like documents, they like audio recordings. I think it's just a natural part of being someone who's interested in radio, you know. So I just started to build that archive, probably starting in the mid-70s. It covers, like, the Irish pirates. It covers offshore radio as well. I mean, I've probably got thousands of hours of recordings from each. It just started by exchanging cassettes with people in Ireland, people in Europe, and just building up the collection, you know. And I suppose my fear is, and why I think, you know, the whole initiative of archiving this is good, that, you know, when I eventually pop this mortal coil, it'll end up in a skip, you know. As has happened with a lot of people who have unfortunately died and their archive has just been disposed of by a family who don't really know the importance of it, you know, and the significance of it, not just from a personal point of view, but from a social point of view, from a development point of view. I mean, that there's much more to the whole radio thing than just listening to it, you know. I think Ireland's a good example of that because, I mean, I've got a view. One of the reasons why radio was so important in Ireland, or pirate radio in the 80s, is it formed a part of escapism, you know. Because, I mean, Ireland during that period, and the mid to late 70s before that, was having some quite trying times, you know. So the fact that radio was there, that was playing music, there were these larger-than-life guys presenting programmes. I think for a lot of people of various ages, it did provide that escapism for them to get away with the worries of the day, whether they'd be unemployed or whatever, you know, and just to lose yourself in music and the crack that was coming over the radio at the time, you know. So I think the Irish pirates played a you know, an important part of the social development of Ireland during the 70s and the 80s, you know.
Was that part of the attraction of it for you, do you think?
No, I mean, I'll be blatantly honest. The attraction for me was to go and do radio and be paid for it, you know. I mean, that's what lured me over there. I suppose it's only natural that when you go to a country like Ireland, and you know the personality that Ireland has, it's going to become more than that, because obviously I've developed a big interest in the country itself, you know, and the culture of the country. And I mean, you know, for the past 20, 30 years, you know, I mean, you know, Ireland and it's formed, you know, a big part of my life, you know. So I think that developed over a period of time, you know, and just, you know, an interest in Irish history and all things Irish. So, but no, going back to, you know, for me, radio was to go there and present and get experience, you know. That was one of the big attractions for me, that, you know, experience that I couldn't get at that time in Scotland, you know.
Was there anything in particular as an outsider coming from Scotland to Ireland that you noticed about the country as you arrived, and then by the time you had left had changed? And in any way, what radio had contributed to that change?
I suppose Ireland has been, you know, developing, you know, over a number of years. You know, sort of views are changing. I suppose radio might have helped people to open their minds just a little bit. You know, I mean, radio does do that. I mean, you know, you could consider, and you know, you correct me if I'm wrong, that there was a, you know, a certain maybe insular mindset in Ireland at that time, you know, and you know, radio coming on and this the gung-ho having a sort of pop at authority aspect of pirate radio maybe help people just to open their minds a little bit, to say, hang on a sec, this is okay, this is fine, you know, we can have a sort of a bit of a revolt against authority, we can do things that maybe we're not quite supposed to do, we're not harming anybody, but we're not following this the official line, you know, that we've been taught by our parents, been taught at school, been taught by the clergy or whatever, you know, we're doing things a little bit differently, and I think radio probably helped just to open that a little bit, yeah.
So you said you got into radio, you know, quite frankly, because you wanted to get paid experience in it. Yeah. But looking back now, you can see the significance of all of this stuff historically. So what for you stands out from your archive of all of the thousands of hours of recordings that you have? What do you think are the particularly important aspects there? Are there any particular recordings that stand out for you?
Well, I suppose a lot of the closed down recordings, they do. I mean,
that's the close down of the 31st of December 1988.
Yeah, but even before that, during the time of the raids and the support that Nova got from people, you know, I mean, you know, Herbert Street was just swarming with faces at that time, you know, and people were raising their voices to say to the government, hang on a sec, we don't like what you're doing here, you know. Maybe we shouldn't be doing this, and, you know, voicing our disapproval, but we're going to do it anyway, you know. So I think the close down certainly. Kiss FM in Monaghan in December 1988, when that was going off the air. I mean, there's a theory by one of the guys who started Kiss FM that it really helped to bring people together in the north, you know. And it may well be the case, it may not, you know. It may have had a part in that. I mean, it was non-religious, you know. It was non-sectarian. It was just playing good pop music that everybody would like, you know. So, I mean, you know, pirate radio... I think contributed in some way, big or small, to the cultural development of Ireland, you know, in the 70s and 80s.
Certainly there was enough of it, and it was big enough, and it was powerful enough to expect it to have that impact. Brian, you want to ask another question?
Yeah, possibly a final question. Ian Bigger, have you any regrets?
About going to Ireland? No, sir. My biggest regret is being as dogmatic as I was then. I mean, I was only like 20, 21, you know, thought I knew everything. And really, at that age, you know nothing, you know. So in retrospect, you know, I would have did certain things a lot differently. I think had I done those things a lot differently, I would have lasted longer on the radio stations over there. But I tended to let my feelings and my emotions get in the way, you know, because I thought I knew what was best for the radio station. And really, I knew a bit, but I didn't know everything, you know. I probably didn't listen to people as much as I should have done, you know. I probably made enemies of people that I shouldn't have done. And as I say, you know, a couple of those people, I've got great regrets that I did make enemies with them and broke up some friendships that that I'd rather we're still good to this day. But in terms of generally any regrets, no, I loved it. I loved every moment of it. You know, it was great.
Last question for me then: what do you think of what Irish radio has become today?
Well, I'll give you a good example of that. I was over in Cork last summer on holiday, and tuning around as you do while driving around Cork and looking for a station at 10 o'clock, half 10 in the morning, playing music, and couldn't find one. So I think my view is, in a lot of ways, Irish radio has stagnated a bit. It sounds, a lot of the stations sound like ILR did in the UK in the 1970s, which was one of the reasons why I came to Ireland in the first place. So I think it's gone full circle in a way. All that real kind of vision around radio and how radio should be, I think, has disappeared. We've got radio consultants coming in, with a very narrow view on what radio should sound like. I mean, I think talking to friends who are still in the industry, I mean, some of the stuff the consultants come up with is good, it's sensible, but I think in a lot of ways it's stifled radio and the development of radio. So no, apart from the few pirates I've heard in Ireland, which some of them are still okay. In Cork, there was a couple of good stations on, very tight stations playing music. But generally, I wasn't that impressed.
And very last word for me: why then do you think that the pirates in Ireland persist? Because there are still some, and you log them and you talk about them and so on.
I think there'll always be a need for pirate radio. There's always a need for someone to buck the system, to do something different, to fly the flag, to switch a transmitter on and just say, well, okay, we've got choice in radio now, but choice could be greater, and we're going to give you that greater choice.
Thank you for sharing your moments from the Comet at 5 years of age to now. Ian Bicker, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ian.